Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msoucy, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on X, at Matthew Soucy. This show is available on iTunes and, like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. So I got a guest on this week's show, filmmaker Robert Muggy. Good guy, really good guy, fun documentary filmmaker. And we had a lively chat earlier this week. And then we'll go around the horn. I had a long week. As you know, there's some family stuff looming over me that's kind of put me in a funk and, trying to get back into the swing of things as far as work and rehearsal. And I don't have a music festival to MC this weekend, so I'm ready to just kind of be home. So to the ex Twitter page, Sad Penguin Time, I know exactly what you're going through. But I do want to mention before we get to the interview, and I didn't get a chance to see anything new this week, and a screener that was supposed to be sent to me didn't, so go at your own peril. But kudos to 1A, which is the news show that's you can hear 10 to noon, Monday through Fridays, on WFYI. But they had a movie club episode on Thursday on bad cinema. So I'm glad that finally 1A has caught up with Film Sociology, which has been on these airwaves for 14 years. Anyway, it was kind of fun to hear some films that get a national platform on NPR, like of course The Room and Manos, the Hands of Fate. And so we had Jen, Paul, Catherine, I just wrote down the guests, and of course the host, Jen White. If I remember right, it was Jen. So, but they took a lot of emails and voicemails, titles including Monster Dog, starring Alice Cooper, Horror at Party Beach, which I have seen with and without Mystery Science Theater treatment, the Alan Arkin film Simon, The Naked Jungle, a Charlton Heston film, Mommy Dearest, Manos, Reefer Madness, Slither, Kick Puncher, The Fearless Vampire Killers, Sharknado, Plan 9 from Outer Space, Golden Arm. The host talked about her love of 80s dance films, so Flashdance, Breakin', Footloose, all that. The guest, John, brought up Honeymoon in Vegas, which I don't think qualifies. It's the subject line of A Female as Property. That's obviously very dated, but it's still a well-made comedy. But he did bring up Skyscraper, and I might have to go dig out Skyscraper. This is the one with Dwayne Johnson, which is said to be a cross between Die Hard and The Towering Inferno. Paul brought up the film Miami Connection, which I got to see in a midnight screening here in town with a full audience, and that was fun as hell, as well as Diana the Musical, the filmed stage play. Paul's, of course, of the How Did This Get Made podcast. Catherine brought up A Girl in Gold Boots, which, and the Mystery Science Theater treatment of Werewolf, which she chooses as the gateway. I love fall allergies. Anyway, other titles, and then they were discussing what makes bad, what makes a film so bad it's good or so bad it's bad. They made a comparison of Manos versus Waterworld, or a failed movie, I guess. So anyway, everybody has a different definition. And it was finally brought up that nobody sets out to make a bad film, but not everyone can make a good film. Somebody brought up, one of the panelists brought up Look Who's Talking Now. There's also the as far as bad cinema, the debate between something that's unwatchable, And for a lot of people, like my family, The Room is unwatchable. Manos, The Hands of Fate is unwatchable. And then those that just have wild choices. Other email suggestions, The Stuff, Warriors of Virtue, which is apparently about Kung Fu Kangaroos, Crawl. I was happy to hear that the panel brought up Staying Alive, which I think I will inflict on my buddy Laura sometime soon, which, yes, this is the sequel to Saturday Night Fever, directed by Sylvester Stallone, when he thought he was a serious filmmaker. And what somebody else on the panel mentioned that guilty pleasures don't exist. And I, to borrow a line from Nigella Lawson, if you feel pleasure, why feel guilty? There are just some show, and they brought up, there's just some films that need to be, to turn your brain off and watch. And they brought up TV shows like Big Bang Theory, Two and a Half Men, Law and Order, where just, you just turn your head off, turn your brain off. The host brought up Mystery Science Theater, of course, which is, like I said, is a great gateway. The Rocky Horror was brought up, but that's a competent film. It just was not ready for a mainstream audience and has since then gained a major, obviously, phenomenon over the last 50 years. My God, that's coming up. Almost 50 years. Showgirls is one I need to revisit. I know that had a cult following, and I know Karina Longworth did a nice treatment of it on You Must Remember This, which, by the way, is back in session with their Lesbian Chic episode of Wild Side and Bound. But that one has a one as far as choices, as far as the over-the-topness of that picture. A couple other titles that were mentioned, 0 Hour, of course, which was the film that inspired Airplane, Milk Money, which I do remember being released in college, but I didn't get a chance to see it. Green Lantern, is another one that I don't know if I can revisit that one. I don't think that was fun, bad. I just thought it was kind of, eh. Anyway, a lot of titles that, I didn't think would be on the airwaves, at NPR and WFYI that did not involve film sociology. Cause I've been talking about these films for years. So, a little pat on the back for myself and the show and you, the film sociology listener, put up with my love for, The Room and Miami Connection and Roar's one, I think that should have been added to this group, but it was, anyway, it was kind of cool to see 1A give some bad cinema a platform. So there you go. All right. With that in mind, let's play my chat with Robert Muggy, who's got a new book. There's a screening of one of his documentaries coming to Franklin, and it's fun to finally have him in studio. So enjoy. Joining me on Film Sociology is, I don't say regular guests, I say usual suspects, and this is definitely one of the usual suspects. He's been on before on the phone. We have him in studio now, and if you're a longtime listener, well, if you've been listening for the last 3 years, one of the strongest contributors to what I call the grab a pencil segment of the show, when you go on social media and give me your scroll list of what films you've watched. Filmmaker, author, and really cool guy, Robert Muggy. How are you, man?
Oh, it's great to be with you.
And also with you. Now that we got service started, he has one of his films, and you go to robertmuggy.com. Man, I'm on it. So
M-U-G-G-E.
What he said. Cool Runnings, the reggae movie, it's a reggae concert documentary, is going to be running Wednesday, September 27th. At 7:30 p.m. at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin, Indiana. So did you have an aneurysm when the Disney bobsled film came out with the same name?
No, I almost got enriched but didn't because...
Trying to go up against the big guys?
Well, no. What happened is, ironically, a lawyer who had been working for Dave Stewart when we made Deep Blues and worked on my contract with him came around saying... this was, you know, a number of years later. Hey, Disney wants to do this bobsleigh film, and they want to call it Cool Runnings. Can we pay for the name? And I said, oh, God, I wish I could let you pay me for the name, but, you know, I don't own the film, such as the film even exists. It's these guys, Tony Johnson and his band of merry men from Jamaica, who have a company called Synergy, and they run Sunsplash every year. And they actually hired me to make the film. So I guess I need. So Tony is in L.A. I guess I better send you to him. And when I called them and said this guy would be calling, I said, remember, you should share a little of that with me for the huge part of my salary I was never paid. And somehow that got overlooked. But they did get paid for use of the name, which is an interesting story because they are two very different films.
Oh, yes, considerably. He also has a new book out called Notes from the Road, A Filmmaker's Journey Through American Music. I guess my first start, Robert, is the Historic Art Craft Theater contacts you. You have dozens of films to choose from. How did this one get catch their eye?
The funny thing is I contacted them.
Ah.
I had not shown. I have a couple of 35mm prints. One is in pristine shape, which I don't show because one day I hope to have the money to do a new like 4K, 5K, whatever transfer of the film. But I have one that's a little ragged, still gorgeous, but that we played 40 years ago, at the London premiere at the London Film Festival in 1983. So this is really the 40th anniversary of the film. And, it's been available on video for years, but from a very early video transfer. So I have not shown it publicly until last month, since I guess the mid-80s. And so I just finished a month ago showing three films at the Roxy Cinema in New York, my Sun Ra film, my Gil Scott-Heron film, and on 35mm, the reggae concert film. So prior to doing that, I thought, I've got to get hold of a 35mm projector. Where the hell is a 35mm projector? So I can check and make sure it's okay. Are the splices okay? That sort of thing. So I got in touch with the Keystone, and they said, yep, we have 35mm projectors, and nope, they're not set up. So they said, tell you what you do. The only other people we know in the whole region that have 35, and I'm guessing that doesn't include the Cinematheque in Bloomington, because I'm guessing they still do, but is Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin, Indiana. And I said, what? Where? And so they told me, and I got in touch with them, and they were great, and they are great. George and Dave and all these other people who work there and have it as a nonprofit, and it's a nonprofit that funds it and has totally renovated it. It's an incredible place to see films. And so their lovely projectionist went through and made sure it was okay. And so I showed it, as I say, a month ago in New York. My wife and I went to New York and sold books, before and after screenings, which is what we're going to do in Franklin.
Hint.
So while I was there, Dave Windisch is telling me, September, we do music films on Wednesday evenings, 4 weeks in a row. We really liked what we saw watching a little of your reggae film. Could we show that? And I said, well, I have three dozen films. It doesn't have to be that one just because you just saw that one. But they said, no, we love showing things in 35mm. That's part of their identity. So I said, great. And so so Diana, my wife, and I are actually going to Philly next week to show my film, my 1978. God, I'm old. Film about Mayor Frank Rizzo, because it's political season there, so that's what they wanted to show, and we're going to sell and sign books there. But we're coming back on the 25th, and then the 27th, as you say, we're showing the reggae film. Unfortunately, nobody seems to have equipment anymore that plays the Dolby 4-channel surround that we had back then. So we'll have to screen it in mono, but it still sounds great in mono, and we'll play it really loud. It's a nice screen, so it's going to be great. And we're going to have copies of the book. Diana's going to be selling them. I'm going to be signing them. It'll be a really fun night especially for a Wednesday night in September.
Absolutely. So the film is about the 1983 Reggae Sunsplash Festival in Montego Bay, Jamaica. And if you go through Robert's filmography at his website, robertmuggy.com, you'll see just a great variety of music that doesn't always get the most representation: blues, jazz, bluegrass, zydeco, Cajun, all R&B. So
Hawaiian music.
There you go. It's like Rounder Records is having a dream of some kind.
And I did make a film about Rounder Records.
See, there you go. So there is that. But anyway, how did you get, and I believe it was a Gil Scott-Heron connection that led you to doing this concert film?
Yes, we had, Gil and I had so much fun working together, and so that film got premiered in the fall of 82. I shot it in the spring of 82. So then spring of 83, my Gil Scott-Heron film was the first film I made for Britain's Channel 4 television, which it was their fourth channel, and it came on the air right as I was finishing up the Gil Scott-Heron film. And so Andy Park, the crazy Glaswegian, meaning from Glasgow, Scotland,
yep,
who funded it, he and I wanted to work together again. And so we were going to do a film on Al Green, but it took 13 months and four trips to see him to convince Al, yes, let's do a film together. And so we did end up shooting that a week before Christmas in Memphis, Christmas of 83. But in the meantime, in the spring of 83, I'm in the middle of this grueling series of trips, as I say, two to Memphis, one to New York, and one to New Orleans to try to hook up with Al and get him to say yes. Gil's manager at the time got in touch with me and said, Gil is going to play Sunsplash in Jamaica this spring, and Gil and I have told them that if they're going to film it, you're the guy to do it. And I was very touched, but they said, listen, the Synergy guys are having a press conference in New York to announce the festival this year, the lineup and everything. Why don't you come up and we'll introduce you to them? Was living in Philly still at the time, got on the train, met the guys, really hit it off with Tony and Ron and Don Green, Ronnie Burke, and the executive director is Tony Johnson. Great guys. Originally, they were going to do what they had done the year before and have a TV crew out of England, shoot the whole thing, and then make a series for British television out of it. But what happened was the producer never got the money together. And so at the last minute, and I was going to direct it for them, Tony Johnson had brought us together. I said, listen, if you can get it, you've already arranged for multi-track recording. If we could get together enough money, if you could get together enough money to pay me to come down and produce and direct and later edit, I can bring my crew. You can bring some, like production assistants, camera assistants, things like that down in Jamaica. And we can just come down and do it. This is the night before I was already supposed to be coming to Jamaica. So at 1 o'clock in the morning, they said, yeah, man, let's do it. And so I quickly at 1 o'clock in the morning on a Friday night called on my guys and arranged that I would go down on Saturday on Air Jamaica. They would go down on Sunday, and then we would start shooting on Tuesday, which was going to be like a outdoor fashion show and stuff. And then I believe it was four nights in a row. Let me think. Yeah. No. Yes. Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night. Only every night it went into the next day. So you'd start shooting in the you'd set up in the afternoon at the festival site, the Bob Marley Performing Center in Montego Bay. It had previously been in Kingston, Jamaica, but this year it was in Montego Bay. And so then you'd start shooting mid-evening. You'd film all night. You'd film until maybe as late as noon. We'd go back to the little resort hotel where we were staying, flop onto beach chairs, just sort of collapse, and looking like, you know,
The Walking Dead.
The Walking Dead. typhoon victims sprawled around the beach. And we'd get maybe 2 hours of sleep.
And do it again.
And do it again. Only it turned out that, you know, we're shooting film back then, and you had these battery belts to operate the cameras. And it turned out that when we plugged in our battery belts overnight, well, it really wasn't overnight. It was just a few hours. And you know, one cameraman would maybe use three belts over the course of a night. Also, it turned out they didn't have very strong electrical utilities in the Montego Bay area. And so we'd get there the next day, and all of a sudden our battery belts are dying. And somehow we made it through that night, but we had to rig up some other ways of dealing with it. And, of course, as you're lying there sprawled on the beach chairs, guys with dreadlocks would come up out of the water with ganja to sell you and everything. It was a wonderful, very challenging experience. And the project was a challenge all the way through because the guys never raised all the money they should have, even though, like, we'd be at the sound mix in New York, and a guy with long dreadlocks, I later found out, was a Jamaican drug dealer, would show up with a paper bag full of $13,000 in cash. And another time, I'm in the middle of editing, and I won't say which one because I don't want to
incriminate.
Yes, anybody, but one of the Synergy guys came up on an Air Jamaica flight from Jamaica, landed at the Philly airport where I picked him up, brought a suit bag full of cash that I was supposed to use to pay the film lab in Richmond, Virginia. But it was a great experience. It's a great film. Unfortunately, it's a film that hasn't been seen a whole lot, especially the way we meant for it to be seen, blown up to 35 millimeter with the Dolby surround and everything. But last month in New York, for the first time since the mid-80s, the 27th at 7:30 p.m. at the Artcraft Theater in Franklin. And then I'm showing seven films at the AFI Silver Theater in the suburbs of D.C., actually Silver Spring, where I grew up, Silver Spring, Maryland. That's one of the films we're going to show there. So it's a rare opportunity if there's any hardcore reggae films out there, but not even just reggae. Gil Scott-Heron, as you and I have discussed, does a 13-minute version of The Bottle with his full band that is just killer. And the climactic songs, Tragile Love and 96 Degrees in the Shade by Third World, are just unbelievable. And Rita Marley and the Melody Makers and Sugar Minot and Reunion of the Scatolites and Alton Ellis, essentially the founder of ska music, and just so many. Chalice.
Gregory Isaacs
doing a killer stoned night nurse. At
Musical Youth
doing a way, way too long version of Pass the Dutchie. Because it had sold 7 million copies at this point. The guy said, we really have to emphasize this.
It's either that or you do it, like, you know, four times in your set.
right.
Of thing. So it was four nights. How many cameras did you have?
Four.
Okay, so I wondered if it was, I know I was recently revisiting The Last Waltz, and where, you know, you one camera here, one camera there, or if one camera's dying, do you throw, I mean, how was that set up?
Scorsese's way of shooting music films has always been to get every camera available, like 20, like
which
when
he did, could, yeah,
wait, right, which he can because he's Scorsese, but like when he did that Rolling Stones film, yeah. I think he had 22 cameras, something like that. And when you go to see it, you see cameras have been shooting cameras. You know, that's what you see on screen is the other cameras. And that's basically what he did with The Last Waltz, which is a wonderful film, but it leaves little to chance, shall we say. So to me, shooting like on average four cameras, sometimes less, on rare occasion more, but it's like I have to know exactly where to place them. And especially because with film cameras, of course, you shoot for 10 minutes, then you have to change magazines, mm-hmm. so there's breaks. So you've also got to have them overlapping so that, you know, you're never without cameras. Like, for instance, that movie Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll.
Taylor Hackford.
Taylor Hackford.
I'm sorry, Mr. Helen Mirren.
Yes, Mr. Helen Mirren.
I know.
We all touch our hearts if you mention her name.
Way to go, Taylor.
Yeah, really. His greatest accomplishment. But when he did the Chuck Berry film, Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll, my longtime cameraman did Steadicam on that film. And he came back and told me what it was like. Well, Taylor Hackford didn't know you could overlap the cameras. So he has all the cameras shooting for 10 minutes over and stopping over and over again. Thank God we didn't do that, since we had on a number of my films, Blues Divas and this and a number of others, you know, 14-minute songs.
But that was also, I think Hail Hail was also a film that involved a bag full of cash because of its subject matter. But that's another chat for another
Actually,
time.
Actually, I was interviewed about maybe shooting that film originally. The woman who lived in New York, who she was known for doing these films like in the 80s, where they would have somebody like Roy Orbison or Carl Perkins or Chuck Berry or whoever, and they do these tributes to them that would be all these young rock stars paying tribute to the veteran. And so she had made her name doing those, starting a style which I really hated, because it's like the original guy isn't enough. You've got to have Bonnie Raitt and Keith Richards and Bob Dylan or Bruce Springsteen all paying tribute to them. She interviewed me, and then next thing I know, right from my interview, she was going out to L.A., where obviously she made a deal with Taylor Hackford, and he made the film.
I think for you young filmmakers out there, for you young audience members, and going back to what we were talking earlier,
which is everybody except me.
No, but I would say it sounds like more Pennybaker than Scorsese as far as this is film. You hope you got it. You don't know. I mean, nowadays you can go through a monitor, especially if you're digital. If you're filming through digital, you know what you have immediately. So there's that kind of crapshoot of between picture and sound, and if they connect.
We did at least very early on start having video assist, which is where, of course, where you're shooting film, but the director has video monitors on cables that are running to all those cameras. Or later, you know, Bluetooth or whatever, and especially if a guy's on Steadicam, it's a little difficult to have a cable running to him. Fortunately, you know, hopefully you hire really good people who the odds are pretty good they're going to get an image on that film that you'll have to edit later on.
And you don't have a Sidney Pollack experience.
Yeah.
Like Amazing Grace. Thank God technology caught up.
You don't want to get me started on that film. One of my least favorite music films of all time. I love Sidney Pollack, but watching him get out there and have no idea what he's doing, and they've got, once again, cameras filming cameras.
Yep.
And it drove me crazy when I saw these rave reviews for the reconstructed released film, and what I saw was basically what I saw actually at the Keystone, the Landmark, was basically a disaster.
Yes. Anyway, the film is Cool Runnings, the reggae movie, Wednesday, September 27th at the Historic Artcraft Theater in Franklin. If you're a film fan of any kind, and if you're a music fan, reggae or otherwise, it's definitely worth checking out. Robert Muggy is the author of Notes from the Road, A Filmmaker's Journey Through American Music. Is this based on a production diary? Do you keep a production diary or a personal diary?
That's a really interesting question.
That's why I asked.
You're a master of those interesting questions. I have a good memory. I don't have a phenomenal memory.
Wow. I can't tell from the book.
Well, thank you. And that's because I kept all my old calendars. I kept all my old production notebooks. I kept all my checkbooks with the stubs of what I paid to whom. I kept my old budgets.
Did you keep the suit bag from the Philadelphia airport?
The cash came in New York.
You put a dollar sign on it like the Monopoly guy.
That would be a fun souvenir to have. But no, I was able to the notebooks in particular. I had so many notes. Very often in those notebooks, I had, blocked out what we're shooting, which day, and so was able to say, yeah, we shot Frankie Ford on this day, we shot Gil Scott-Heron on this day,
mm-hmm.
And there was a huge help, and I also did interview a few of my crew members. And one in particular, Chris Lee, who's been a cameraman of mine since the Sun Ra film in 78, he had a lot of good memories, and a production manager of mine, Bob Mayer, a camera assistant and later cameraman of mine, Craig Smith, they had stories. One funny story, which I put in the book, which happily you've read, so you'll have heard it before.
Yes, sir.
Is Craig was part of what he and an African-American gentleman named Quincy McKay had both studied with friends of mine at the University of Memphis. And when I started doing a lot of films down south, my friends recommended them. And they're both hilarious guys. And Craig was just... I mean, he's one of the guys people don't understand about the South. He lived in a rural area, but his dad owned four banks, and he was well educated and brilliant, and a photographer, and he's now actually a male nurse, but he is a still photographer who had his own company, and for me, he would be a production assistant or a camera assistant or a cameraman. And just hilarious. And Quincy had actually had, I think, a mild stroke or something really young, and then totally recovered, except he got a bit of a stutter. And so he learned, he had a great sense of humor, but he would give you these looks. Like Craig would say something, and he would just give hilarious looks in response, or like one-liners. And so the two of them became the comic relief for so many of the big films we made down south, like Deep Blues or Rhythm and Bayous, or the three films we made simultaneously. Or did they? Yes, they were with us on those. The Kingdom of Zydeco, True Believers, the musical family of Rounder Records, and Gather at the River, a bluegrass celebration. But he told me a story when he came up to see my wife Diana and me. He told a story which I had forgotten, which is how I would, big-hearted, I would sometimes let people come work on my productions, like from Canada or New York City, to let them get the experience.
Or Ball State,
eventually, where I did a number of films where my crews were entirely Ball State students, yeah. But sometimes they would do wonderful things, and sometimes they would do horrible things, like this guy from Canada who smoked constantly when no one else on the crew smoked. And we would hire all these minivans, but only certain people.
Yeah.
were allowed to drive them. And he got sick one night, took one of the many vans to drive himself to the hospital and crashed it. So I sent his ass back to Canada. And so Craig told this great story about, he said, remember the guys in red suits on Star Trek? He said, those guys at the beginning of the episode, you always knew one of them was going to be eaten by an alien monster or otherwise, or fall down a ravine and be crushed by a landslide or whatever. And he said, at the start of every production, we looked around and wondered which guy was the red suit guy.
Who lasts longer, red shirts on Star Trek or Little Joe's fiance on Bonanza?
Exactly.
not very long. So as I'm going through the book, Notes from the Road, I it's funny, and of course I'm not a filmmaker, but I saw as I was reading it, and great stories about how a film gets made, and breaking it down into the subject, the funding, the traveling, the filming, the crafting, post-production, editing.
And the real abuse, which begins when you're ready to distribute it.
And, the release. Right. So it follows that format, like Blues, and goes in different directions, like Blues, with each story. I mean, you know, each film that you've worked on, you know, I know you try, you keep it at a similar approach, but curveballs come in all shapes and sizes, whether it's funding or Sun Ra or the weather or, smoking PA or whatever.
Or on Deep Blues, the devil, one thing. But also rival power centers, which got in our way on location in deepest, darkest areas of Mississippi and everything.
But who of the subjects you've interviewed, who has been the biggest, the easiest, and who has been the most difficult to work with?
That is so funny. You are the second person in 12 hours to ask me that question.
And this isn't necessarily for Babylon Dirt purposes, but you know, you got to work with a person.
Babylon 10 will have the muggy stories. I remember when the first one came out, actually. Again, showing how old I am. Now I forgot the question after all that goofy run. The who was difficult. Okay. Often somebody starts out being difficult, and then you decide you really like them anyway. And one such person was Alison Krauss. And Alison Krauss, who sings like an angel, plays a wonderful violin, is just a first-rate talent in every way. But one thing I learned, which is just an aside, is when we went to record her, is she sings really, really quietly. Mm-hmm. And that apparently is part of how she gets this really kind of ethereal sound to her voice. But when we filmed, I was simultaneously, as I say, making a bluegrass film, a Zydeco film, and a Rounder Records film. And for the Rounder Records film, we went to Austin, we went to Memphis, we went to Southwest Louisiana, we went to Owensboro, Kentucky, where the World of Bluegrass events were being held. We were all over the place. And in Owensboro, we thought, great, we're going to get, here's the biggest selling person in bluegrass and also making it in country music and everything. She'll be our biggest star for both the Rounder film and the bluegrass film. So we get to World of Bluegrass events in Owensboro, and she's the co-host of the big award show that they're broadcasting nationally and stuff. But it rained while we were in Owensboro, and she felt that it affected her voice, especially when we filmed, you know, she did like a song during the indoor award ceremony, but she did a whole wonderful set outdoors, and we're thinking, this is killer, we're going to have so much material from this and everything, until we get home, and her manager calls and says, Alison says you can't use any of her footage for either film because she's sure that it affected her voice. So
Artist whim,
but, you know, I'm sure she genuinely felt like this. She was being sincere. It just cause enormous pain
yes.
for everyone at Rounder and at BMG, who was funding these three films simultaneously, and me. And so David Steffen of BMG needed the Bluegrass film first because he had made a deal with the Nashville Network to show a one-hour version of it and pay a chunk of money towards the production cost.
So they digitally replaced her with Christopher Plummer. You film fans, you'll know exactly that joke, so there's that.
Okay. but no, I had to quickly finish the film without her. Did have a couple of good female artists in it, but bluegrass, like blues, was traditionally a really male-dominated film, and here the biggest artist in bluegrass can't be in it. So then I made the Zydeco film and got it. So the Nashville Network showed it in February, their hour version, and David Steffen immediately got out the home video version. I raced to get the Zydeco film done next, and at the same time I was finishing that, Rounder arranged, I was still living in Philly, and Rounder arranged with Allison and one of her musicians to come to Philly to WXPN-FM, the University of Pennsylvania AAA station. And so we filmed her recording a session that really was for us, but that was going to be on World Cafe, the syndicated nationwide WXPN show. And so that's when I really figured out how quietly she performed and everything. And she actually was lovely. We really, really liked her. And so at least we did get her into the Rounder film. But this happened again.
So she basically, she kicked you in the chest, but she signed the footprint that went over your body.
Yes, she did.
Okay, good.
And that worked. And so it forever is a detriment for the bluegrass film, which still, it's basically a Peter Rowan film. I mean, he does he hosts it. He does all kinds of incredible stuff throughout it. And we have lots of other, Ralph Stanley, California,
Del McCurry
doing incredible songs, two of his own and one with Tim O'Brien, who also did another song. It's a lot of great people. So anyway, flash forward years later, I'm the filmmaker in residence at Mississippi Public Broadcasting for 2 years. And I did several projects there. All of my projects were about African-American culture in Mississippi. But the big one I did was called Blues Divas. And the idea I came up with was to do Morgan Freeman, Morgan Freeman and my late friend Bill Luckett owned Ground Zero Blues Club in Clarksdale, exactly. And so they agreed that if we shot everything there, all the performances for this film and series, it was to be an 8-hour series for public broadcasting and a 2-hour compilation film for theaters. And then my plan was to have 8 long form, because it was 8 women, Irma Thomas, not Marsha Ball wasn't available, unfortunately. Shamika Copeland wasn't available. A number of people weren't available. But Betty Levette, who was just starting to make her comeback.
Yep.
Mavis Staples, Denise LaSalle, the incredible Denise LaSalle, one of the raciest, most wonderful performers ever, who got to be a really, really good friend. Just loved her to death. Ann Peebles of High Records fame, Deborah Coleman, Deborah Coleman.
Miss her.
Yeah, me too.
Renee Austin,
who Odetta. Well, it was originally going to be 7, but Renee Austin's manager got in touch with me and said, she'll perform for next to nothing if you add her. And so we did, and she was wonderful. But she was actually the only white singer in the, because it was all about a sort of a Mississippi diaspora. Mm. Oh, and Odetta.
Odetta, yeah. Quick Renee Austin story, because I have one. She played at the Slippery Noodle years and years and years ago, back when she was on Blind Pig.
And while she was still doing blues and not gospel.
Exactly. And yeah, I think it was a Tuesday night. So, you know, you have the, my imaginary garage band name is called the Wooing Caucasians. You know, they were there, as per usual. And halfway through the show, her band gets up and heads to the bar. And I thought, well, you're not calling for a break. She then goes and does Amazing Grace by herself.
Right.
And that was part
of her show.
As if that wasn't impressive enough. But the long neck drinking crowd also shut up and listened. It was impressive. I mean, because usually you have one Freebird yelling dude in the back and just kind of, you know, mucks up the atmosphere, but not that night.
Well, as you know, she later had vocal problems.
Yep.
And stopped singing for years, finally got it back. I don't know if she fully got it back, but her performance in Blues Divas is extraordinary.
Yeah.
Anyway, Starbucks had agreed to put out an album that they would sell in their stores,
mm-hmm.
of music from all these musicians. And everybody was fine with it, but Mavis Staples, who said, "My voice wasn't up to par." And I later saw an interview with her where she said, well, 50% of the time her voice isn't up to par. But she was great. And she didn't keep us from using her. Well, we had a contract. She couldn't keep us from using her in the film or the series. But why, if she couldn't do the same song on CD that she did in the film, or, you know.
We should all shoot for Mavis Staples at 50% level.
Oh, please, yes. God, what an ideal to aspire to.
And I'm just going to ask this because I kind of set it up from the earlier question. Sun Ra claimed to be from outer space, but they have a very harsh business practices in outer space too, as well. Is that fair?
I've never heard it put quite that way.
Well, I mean, because you know, yes, you're your own universe, but you're also a businessman. We kind of see that in reading it in the book.
Well, and he was, and he had very strict life rules for
sure.
His band, and he didn't want them doing drugs. He wanted them spending as little time with women as possible. He felt that women distracted.
They weaken legs, I believe, as boxing managers have once said.
That says it. Really.
Yeah, thanks, Burgess.
Right. What, that was in a Rocky film?
I think it was in the first Rocky film.
That's
Well, then there's the famous water pitcher scene in Raging Bull, which we'll just leave it at that.
Well, anyway, the late June Tyson was the one key. He did have a couple of women who were dancers as well, but, you know, he didn't want the women living at the house. He didn't want the women around for rehearsal unless it was June. But he was tough. And actually, I don't know if we've talked about this, but I did, over the 2 years we spent on that film, mostly because it took me so long to actually get money to be able to finish it, because it was initially made without money, just as a labor of love, with a whole lot of my filmmaker friends contributing their time and their equipment, you know, for free, or with the thought that maybe one day they could be paid, because I was doing the Tom Sawyer, come whitewash this fence
yes.
with me, you'll have the greatest time.
Right.
And with Sun Ra, they did. I forget where I was taking that.
Business practice, Sun Ra's rules.
Oh, I'm sorry. But over the course of 2 years, I interviewed him a good number of times. So I actually have a sequel that I will eventually release for this book. It's going to be called Quotes from the Road. And it's all these incredible interviews I've done with all these people over the years, and then only use a few lines in
right.
the film. But with Sun Ra, you know, I just have a vat of gold from him, because and he goes off in great length about all these musicians, and they mustn't believe in freedom. They must believe in discipline and all that. And, you know, you don't want to be slaves in all these cities, you know, slaves to your wives and kids, slaves to your the government, slaves to the tax man, slaves to anything. You've got to just give that up and come live with me. And
did he not think Sonny Rollins practiced enough on the bridge? Not just too much. Didn't break his ankle hard enough in the jump in the time.
Yeah, he believed in like working around the car. Well, you've seen the film. In the film, the musicians talk about, you know, you have to be ready whenever he calls rehearsal. It could be 6 in the morning. It could be 6 o'clock at night. It could be 24
ready.
Hours a day.
Yeah.
But, you know, especially the half dozen guys who would live with them in the house in the Germantown section of Philly, you know, it was, I mean, in a good way, it was like a cult, you know. And
I wasn't going to use that word, but since you did, yeah.
A bunch of them called him master and stuff, you know. They looked at him that way.
Wow. The book is called Notes from the Road, A Filmmaker's Journey Through American Music. Robert Muggy's documentary, Cool Runnings, the Reggae Movie, is screening Wednesday, September 27th at 7:30 p.m. at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin. You're going through the pages.
Do you have time for me to read a quick
Absolutely.
Sun Ra win?
That's so NPR. Please.
Oh, there's so many to read.
Remember, we have. I don't want to edit.
Okay, here's a fun one, because it also has to do with the movie Space is the Place, which so many Sun Ra fans know about.
Yeah.
This one. Wait. I'm sorry. You may have to edit.
You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI. Or hey, don't worry. This audience is used to the heavy IMDb scrolling that happens during the show when I'm doing tribute to somebody who has died recently, and I'm like, oh yeah,
funny.
They did this film. So anyway, now I think you're set up now, Robert Muggy.
I'm trying. The microphone is casting a deep shadow across my book, but I'll
okay.
try.
All right.
This is after we'd managed to do all the shooting and everything.
Uh-huh.
After amassing such amazing footage, I spent several months editing it together. Then, when I finally had something to show, I invited Sun Ra over to have a look. Of course, I was then living in an Italian-American enclave of South Philadelphia, which had been fine while making my films on composer George Crumb and Mayor Frank El Rizzo, but was a bit problematic during the making of this one. Local residents were not accustomed to having African Americans entering their neighborhood at night, especially ones who were so distinctively dressed. So, and as everyone who's Sun Ra fans know, they dressed in outfits that were somewhere between low-budget sci-fi and ancient Egypt. And,
correct.
Yeah. So when Sun Ra and a few orchestra members arrived wearing only slightly less than full concert regalia, and my neighbors seated on lawn chairs in front of their row houses showed concern, I did my best to reassure everyone, as I also ushered my guests from the crowded street into my second and third floor corner apartment. Once inside, we all climbed the stairs to my third floor editing room and watched everything I had assembled thus far. To my great relief, they loved it all. But what took me aback was how, whenever Sun Ra delivered philosophical concepts on screen, he and his companions would break out laughing. What I quickly deduced was that, although Sun Ra and his followers believed all of his sci-fi riddles and spiritual parables to the point where the musicians who were closest to him called him master, they also realized his presentation was a show, an enormous multi-leveled artwork, and that it utilized a unique form of cosmic jive. So they could fully subscribe to his overriding message while still being amused by his audacity. In effect, I had been invited behind the wizard's curtain and permitted to witness his conjuring firsthand. At that point, happy with what he had seen and heard, Sun Ra pulled out a 16-millimeter print of the fiction film Space is the Place, a production in which he had starred but which he had not yet allowed to be released. Like other Sun Ra fans, I had purchased the film's soundtrack record several years before, then waited in vain for the film to follow. What had happened, Sun Ra said, was that he had been involved in the film's creation and truly enjoyed those sections seeking to dramatize his musical mythology. However, he was distressed by the blaxploitation elements, namely pimps and prostitutes, which had been added later on, probably to increase the project's commercial appeal. Therefore, Sun Ra now asked that I watch the film with him, then remove everything that he felt cheapened his message and that I thought could be sacrificed without damaging the narrative. He then phoned the producer in California and declared that he would be returning the print to him and that what remained after our cuts could be released. Although I had no further involvement with the production, I feel sure that the 64-minute version available largely on VHS for the next two or three decades was the one Sun Ra had approved that night, only after he and I had abridged it. Eventually, of course, years after Sun Ra's death, the scenes that had so offended him would be restored and the entire film widely released at last. Regardless, with Sun Ra business out of the way, we returned to my second floor living... Regardless, with Sun Ra's business out of the way, we returned to my second floor living room where I served my guests chocolate chip cookies and iced tea. And Sun Ra surveyed a poster for Amateur Night at City Hall, my 75-minute portrait of Philadelphia Mayor Frank L. Rizzo. This bellicose former cop and police commissioner was nationally known as a racist and autocratic bully, yet was loved and admired in the city's white working-class neighborhoods, including the one in which I currently resided. As Sun Ra turned away from the poster again, I fully expected him to excoriate Rizzo, at least for the infamous police assaults on hippies, Black Panthers, protesting Black school children, and others that had happened on his watch. However, hewing to his trademark unpredictability, Sun Ra expressed, quote, no problem, unquote, with Rizzo. To the contrary, he said he merely wished that, quote, that Black people had a Rizzo, unquote, by which he meant someone to protect them and watch over their interests exactly as Rizzo did for those who had elected him. Next, learning that I owned LP collections of early Fletcher Henderson and Duke Ellington recordings, he asked to hear some, and I proudly complied. As each new song began to play, Sun Ra would explicate the arrangement for us, and since he had been a pianist and arranger for Henderson's band in the late 1940s, there was no reason to doubt his explanations. In fact, I suddenly realized that this giant of modern music was giving a jazz masterclass in my living room, just as he no doubt did on a regular basis at the house in Germantown. And what I took away from that night, as he produced his ever-present cassette recorder and taped his favorites of the numbers now playing, was total confirmation that he had mastered basic jazz theory and practice before dragging both into the space age. Later, he said, he would transcribe these arrangements and teach them to his musicians. So that's one small part of the Sun Ra section of the book, as you know.
That is from Notes from the Road, A Filmmaker's Journey Through American Music. You can go meet Robert and see the film Cool Runnings, the Reggae Movie, Wednesday, September 27th, 7:30 p.m. at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin, historicartcrafttheater.org, or you can go to robertmuggy.com.
And you can buy the book if you tune up to the... And I'll sign it for what it's worth at the screening.
And before I let you go, because I got you in here, you answered it partly already. Can you watch it in someone else's music documentary? Or are you sharpening knives and taking notes?
It's so funny you mentioned that. I just watched the Wayne Shorter film.
Ooh.
Which one of your one of the people who
one of the usual suspects
on, on your Facebook page recommended, and hey, different strokes for different folks, you know. But I my wife and I were fairly appalled. It's more than 3 hours long, divided into three sections, each of which is pretentiously described on Amazon, where you can watch it for free. But it's just unbelievable. I decided watching it that as brilliant, as creative as Wayne Shorter was, he probably was on the spectrum. Because when you watch that film, he has so little affect. He also is not the most, although brilliantly creative, he's not the best describer of his own work, his own intentions. And the filmmaker has taken interviews with him, combined them with actors playing him at different ages.
Oh, like I'm Not There.
Yes, like I'm Not There, which I also have some issues with. Even though it's a brilliant film in many ways, I have a lot of problems with it. But then, instead of having long, sensitive interviews with people who can really help us to know him, she puts the interviews in a shredder. My friend Frances Davis, the music writer, she has about 10 seconds of him one time, and he never comes back again. Sonny Rollins comes back several times, but without ever fully being able to develop his ideas. So she just has all these scattershot pieces of interview about people who knew and worked with Wayne Shorter, and way too many people just saying how wonderful he was, but with very little evidence, because you never get more than a few seconds of music without somebody talking over top of it, or these big, horrendous, animated sci-fi images coming in and out and totally dominating the screen. And we have a 65-inch TV, so they were damn big as they were. They were the kind of things that people who don't know what they're doing put into Sun Ra-related films, but instead they're for him because he happens to have been a big fan superhero movies, okay, and did a comic book as a kid. So there's all these comic book images superimposed. So if you want to see a great review of the book, Richard Brody's New Yorker review is just right on the money. He praises, you know, greatly Wayne Shorter and his music, but says, oh my God, this animation. Oh my God, these interviews. And that's basically the way we felt. I will tell you, though, I did see on the Criterion Channel this film this week, my wife and I did, a film we just loved, which had nothing to do with music, although it did
I was going to get to that because, like, you know, you have to unwind sometime.
Yes. And although it did have a little too loud of music playing sometimes during the film, but it's the film, what's it called? Turn Every Page? It's a film about Robert Caro, the great history writer, and Robert Gottlieb, the great American editor, and how they worked together first on the book about Robert Moses, the builder in New York City, and then the multiple parts of his long-running Lyndon Johnson series of documentaries. Were you able to pull up the...
No, I'm working on it.
Okay. But yeah, it's by Lizzie Gottlieb.
Turn Every Page, The Adventures of Robert Caro and Robert Gottlieb.
Yeah, it's a more traditional documentary, but everything that's wrong with the Wayne Shorter film, well, not the music part, but she gets into these brilliant interviews that are moving and take you deeply into the projects that they did together and ideas about writing and ideas about editing. And it's just beautifully shot, intimately shot. And so there are films that I love there are films that I'm not so much a fan of. And very often the ones that I love are ones that are different from the kinds of films I make because I respect them for what they do that's different from what I do.
Can you give a recent example?
Well, I can
like
give
of a,
it
of a feature.
Oh, okay.
Or do you want to save it for Thursdays on Facebook?
Oh, it's just you should have let me know in advance.
Well, you were coming here.
Well, you know, I spend way too much time on the Criterion Channel, just as I spend way too much time, as does my wife, on MSNBC. And so what I've been watching a lot of recently and over the last few years during the pandemic and all is wonderful films from the from the pre-code area, the early sound films. Yeah. And we've talked about it, and I've even said it in comments recently on your page. But what I love about those films is that cinema is being reinvented. Yep. You know, everything they learned to do in the silent era, you know, moving the camera, fast cutting, going deeply into visual storytelling, you know, not just Ernst Lubitsch and Alfred Hitchcock, but a whole, and Buster Keaton, but a whole range of people. And so here, they've now got these big clunky cameras that make huge noise, and now they've got to record dialogue. And so they've, things you saw in movies like Singing in the Rain and stuff.
Yeah.
But they've got to find ways to record dialogue without the, so they put the cameras in huge crates. And so it takes a couple of years for anybody to figure out how to move the camera again. But yet you get people like Ernst Lubitsch who instantly adapted to dialogue and kept visual storytelling a part of it. So you have one of the most brilliant films ever made, which is on the Criterion Channel right now, Trouble in Paradise, and one of my wife's favorite films, Designed for Living, two early Lubitsch films. But you also have all these B movies and lesser films, but that are still full of lots of small joys that have to do with how racy the films got in the years before the code fully came in, the Hays office in 35, and wonderful performances by, you know, the young Barbara Stanwyck, the young Spencer Tracy, the young Myrna Loy, the young William Powell, all these great artists. So I've been watching those things just left and right, often with Diana joining me. Actually, there was a fun one they've got on the Criterion Channel right now. I can't think of his name, but he's a director who didn't get to do a lot of films because he kept roughing up his producers. He kept
Norman Mailer
along the lines of, but so they have three gangster films that he did, and he really knew gangsters, so he brought,
of course,
realism to them. And so we watched one the other day with a very young Spencer Tracy, who rises from sort of creating a union of truck drivers into sort of taking over businesses and with full-fledged mafia. This guy's name was like Balcom or something like that.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not finding it. Sorry.
But anyway, I can't think of one film right now that I just – a fiction film that I just totally want to rave about.
Well, we'll find out on Thursday. And then the show will be on Friday, so no worries.
Oh, you mean when I'll write it on your okay.
Do you? I'm curious. Do you keep a notepad? I have a lot of people that keep a notepad, like by their TV or by their bed.
Well, I will admit to you what I have had to do so that I remember what films to tell you when Thursday comes around is my last couple of year long. I have wall calendars. My wife keeps all her notes in her phone. I keep mine on giant wall calendars because I need visual aids to remind me of every little thing. So there are sections on the margins of these calendars where I have these endless lists of films that I've been watching so I remember to tell you.
Oh, I'm touched to be a part of your wall.
And a great many of them are pre-code films.
None wrong with that. Once again.
Oh, I watched a good film the other day.
Yes, sir.
Okay. They have a series of Alan Dwan films right now on the Criterion Channel, and one of them was Frontier Marshal, which is, I think, the first film version of the gunfight at the OK Corral, Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday. And I was amazed at how good this was, with Cesar Romero playing playing Doc Holliday and Randolph Scott playing Wyatt Earp. It was a really fine film, and my wife hates Western, so I didn't invite her to join me.
That happens. That's all right. Cool. Once again, Cool Runnings, the reggae movie, is going to be at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin Wednesday, September 27th at 7:30 p.m. There'll be a film intro, a Q&A. There'll be stuff to buy, and including Notes from the Road, a filmmaker's journey through American music.
Ooh, and they have both popcorn and beer there.
Yeah, it's even better. And you can go to robertmuggy.com for all the films that are available. No beer. That's on you. Go get your own. And, yeah, so support your filmmakers that live in Muncie and have become one of the usual suspects here on Film Sociology.
And the wonderful Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin, where these guys, the only people in the region, at least outside of Bloomington, that have real 35-millimeter films. You can watch analog cinema.
Exactly. Robert, thank you for coming by.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. All right, friends, grab a pencil. Let's find out what you've been watching this week. Once more, Hell Comes the Frog Town is this week's subject of Golden Globus Theater. So go check out that podcast. Fun group, fun couple guys over there. All right, we start with Melissa, who writes, "A Million Miles Away, and You Are So Not Invited to My Bat Mitzvah." Joshua enjoyed that as well. Aaron writes, "I watched the Jurassic World movies this week. I hadn't seen them yet. I still wish I hadn't." Josh writes, "Kelsey, everyone should watch it. Don't let your fandom get in the way. Beautiful film." K-E-L-C-E. Jessica writes, "Guardians of the Galaxy 3, The Harbinger, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the newer one, and Toxic Avenger. I couldn't make it through this one." That happens, Jessica. That's all right. David writes, "Thunderbirds Are Go and Metropolis." Doug writes, "Kismet, Boy on a Dolphin," early Sophia Loren. Oh, I'm very familiar with Boy on a Dolphin, Doug. We all know that moment, that scene. Thank you, Sophia. The Blues Brothers, the 1996 film version of Twelfth Night, and The Matrix. Eric has two first-time viewings this week, which just happened to both deal with prison. Gordon Parks' excellent musical biopic, Lead Belly, from 1976, and the early sound film The Big House from 1930, the well from which all prison movie cliches sprang. Thank you, Eric. Lou Harry writes, "Frankenstein Created Woman." Amanda writes, "My Big Fat Greek Wedding 3. Brian, imitating Eric, "First Time Views, Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem, and Talk to Me. Holy bleep, this is so good." And notable rewatch, Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, Extended Edition. This really does improve that entry. Okay. Amanda also writes, "To see the Ron Spencer movie twice under." Thank you, Amanda. Adam writes, "Edge of Tomorrow." Kurt writes, "Best Exotic Marigold Hotel at Beltrace." Yeah, thank you, Austin. Medium Cool Podcast, never forget that. Ed writes, "Had to turn someone on to the Iron Giant, and I'm very glad we did." Well, Robert Muggy, but I'll read it anyway. He's great. Frontier Marshal, High Tension, Turn Every Page, The Adventures of Robert Caro and Robert Gottlieb, Zero Gravity, and You Are So Not Invited to My Bat Mitzvah. JJ writes, Midnight Run and Earthquake. Chloe writes, Killer Joe and Clute. Chloe, I hope that's not a double feature. Daniel, that's a real statement. I'm hoping you don't have to respond, but yeah, not a good double feature. But two good films, just separately. And don't eat chicken. Daniel writes, The Miracle of Morgan's Creek, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, Hello God, It's Me, Margaret, The Mirror Cracked, and Witness for the Prosecution. Kevin writes, Stop Making Sense. Devin writes, Haunted Mansion, 2003 and 2023, as well as The Fault in Our Stars. Terry writes, Experiment Perilous, seven short films by Dustin Guy Diffa. Hollywood Chinese, the Chinese and American feature films, and House of Usher. Linda writes, Love Again. Gary writes, Brad and Benny Make a Bet, Full-Time Killer, The Brain from Planet Eris, The SpongeBob Movie, Sponge Out of Water, Planet of the Vampires, and Return of the Seven. Bill writes, the remake of 310 to Yuma, Psycho, and Passage to Marseille. Kelly writes, The Wonder. David writes, The Graduate. Andy writes, Annihilation. And finally, Joe writes, Space Camp, Foul Play, and French Kiss. And there you go, friends. That's what you've been watching this week. So hopefully you got to watch some good films that are new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent Breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's some out there. I'm hoping I will be less in the funk next week. But thanks again to Robert Muggy for coming down and making the trip and doing some in-studio shenanigans. Go check out his screening when it comes. Of course, Indie Bard Fest is coming up in October, and we'll have some actors from and set crew people from Indie Bard Fest shows coming on Film Sociology, turning it into Stage Sociology very soon. Anyway, thanks for listening. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
Okay. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!